the Society of Nuclear Medicine and Molecular Imaging welcomes you to the SNMMI podcast series. This new series focuses on deep dives into hot topics for nuclear medicine and molecular imaging professionals, featuring findings and anecdotes from some of the preeminent thought leaders in our profession.
Welcome to the latest episode of the SNMMI podcast series. I am SNMMI President Munir Ghassani. Today, I'm honored to speak with Dr. Simon Cherry, Professor of Biomedical Engineering and Radiology at UC Davis. At the recent SNMMI annual meeting, we welcomed Dr. Cherry as our Kasson Lecturer, where he gave an impassioned speech exploring time and its role in nuclear medicine. From the historical developments occurring over decades to the acceleration of new technologies that can detect photons with a temporal resolution of tens of picoseconds. It was such an inspiring talk that we wanted to continue the conversation. Dr. Cherry, welcome, and thanks for joining me.
Munir, it's a great pleasure to be with you today.
So could you expand on your theme about time, which you had multiple meanings in your Kasson lecture, and you referenced several times during that lecture?
Yes, I've always been fascinated by time. You know, I was a physics undergraduate, and I always remember perhaps the most exciting thing I learned during my undergraduate degree was about the theory of relativity and how time is not constant. And then there's also the human perception of time, right? We all know that we don't experience time in a constant fashion. Any sports fan knows that if their team is winning with just a few seconds left, those seconds seem like an eternity. So I've always been fascinated by time. But of course, it's very central to our field as well, because the image that we get after we inject a radio tracer depends absolutely on the time that we take that image. And the distribution of that radio tracer evolves in the body over time. And we perhaps don't take as much advantage of that always as we might. And then, of course, the final piece of time in our field is time of flight PET, where we're now talking about time scales on the order of tens or hundreds of picoseconds. So incredibly, incredibly small time scales where we measure the difference in arrival time of the two photons that we detect in PET in order to better localize where the signal's coming from. And my lab is very involved in trying to develop next generation technology that can push that timing resolution closer and closer to the point where it will be good enough if we can get down to 20, 30 picoseconds or so that we can actually directly generate an image without going through the image reconstruction step. And that's sort of the ultimate holy grail, I think, as an imaging physicist in our field, is to get to that point where we create PET images with no image reconstruction. We know exactly where the events are coming from. And that should lead to some pretty spectacular images with great spatial resolution, great temporal resolution, all kinds of interesting opportunities initially in research and hopefully in the end developing new clinical applications as well.
This is quite enlightening. The question I have, which is I'm sure in the minds of many in the audience listening to this, is that this opens up the door in so many new areas and applications in neurology, oncology, cardiology, and beyond. But in your own opinion, where do you think in the next 5 to 10 years, the maximal promise of this is going to be, which is an instant success in your own mind? Where do you think these key advantages are going to be in the future?
It's always hard to predict the future, right? The dangerous thing to do. I mean, obviously, nuclear medicine has been incredibly successful in oncology. And so the question is, how do we take that paradigm and repeat that in some other areas? And what are the most promising areas? So now we have, you know, PET scanners with these extended fields of view where we can image large fractions of the total body all at once. And we can do that with really good signal to noise. You know, I think the obvious areas you think about, you already mentioned cardiovascular applications, so we can see the entire cardiovascular system at once. And then I think the other obvious area, given what we've just been through in the world in the last, you know, 3 years, is infectious disease. You know, I think the intersection of these new imaging technologies with really good sensitivity and large coverage across the body with new radio tracers that can target specific aspects of the immune system. So I'm thinking of tracers, for example, that combine to T cells. I think gives us a huge opportunity in infectious disease. You know, initially, perhaps more in the research area to really understand, if we take COVID-19 as an example, you know, the evolution of the disease, interventions, effects of vaccination and boosters. Long COVID is an obvious area for us to study and to really be able to see what's happening with the immune system longitudinally in these patients. So I think there are many opportunities, and there are probably many I'm not even thinking about right now that other people listening in will be thinking about.
You mentioned about the future workforce, and as you are probably aware, that SNMMI has one of the target areas of workforce pipeline that it is addressing on three different levels. One is for the physicians, the other one is for the technologists, and the third one is for the scientists. Now, these are traditional domains. Based on what you just mentioned about the future enthusiasts who will be taking the field to the next level, and based on the promises of very fine temporal resolution and other things that are coming out of the developments, are there any other areas besides these three traditional buckets that we think about where you will see future needs of workforce pipeline that needs to be met to move the field forward?
Well, I think that encompasses the key areas, but I think it's perhaps the intersection with other, you know, particularly when we're talking about the physicians, intersection with other medical disciplines. If we take the example of imaging the immune system, immunology is incredibly complicated. I, as a physicist, barely understand the first thing about it. But what I have come to appreciate as we've been doing studies in COVID-19 is just how incredibly complex it is. So we need people that really understand this to be engaged. And at the same time, they've got to understand enough about imaging as well and nuclear medicine and what we can do to be able to ask the right questions that we can address that with our technology and methods. So it's that sort of communication and how we build teams that bring together the different expertise. And as you rightly point out, those teams need to involve all three of those pillars. You need the physicians who are going to ask the right questions. You know, the technologists are key to implementing high quality, robust, reliable imaging, and also really making the patient experience everything that it needs to be. And on the scientific side, we need a range of different disciplines. Obviously, we're designing more and more specific radio tracers. We still have great needs in that area. So our radiochemists and chemists are really important. People that understand the fundamental biology are really important in the team, as are physicists and engineers who will hopefully make our techniques ever more quantitative and robust. And so we need to build these coalitions, and we need to have many centers that have these teams working together. And you see good examples of this already, but we need more of it. And we need it in some of the less traditional areas outside of oncology.
So it looks like we collectively, as nuclear medicine physicians, the technologists, as well as the scientists, we'll have to start collaborating with multiple other specialties that stand to benefit the most with this promise of new technologies that are evolving.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way I see it. And the key is identifying, you know, the people in these other areas that are willing to take the time to invest in us as well. It goes both ways, right? We need to invest in them and they need to invest in us. And how we get more of an awareness of what our field is capable of beyond what we do clinically, which is already great, but I think getting people aware of what we can do at the high end of research to really contribute knowledge across different medical disciplines will draw top people from different fields into our field as well. And I think that's what we have to do. So we have to get out to the other societies, we have to get out to these other meetings, and we have to promote what we're capable of doing, which is quite astonishing if you compare where we were, you know, 20, 30 years ago. It's incredible what we can do in nuclear medicine today. And again, not just on the imaging side, but increasingly on the therapeutic side as well.
And now, a quick word from our sponsor. Connect with your professional society and become an SNMMI member. SNMMI is dedicated to making sure members like you have the resources, support, and important information you need. Join today and let SNMMI help you navigate your workplace, your career, and your profession. Already a member? Renew your SNMMI membership for 2023 and continue enjoying everything SNMMI has to offer. To join or renew today, visit snmmi.org/join. That's snmmi.org/join. Now, back to the conversation.
Now, these have been few crazy years living through the pandemic. How have you navigated the challenges both personally and professionally? And do you think the pandemic has slowed down or reduced the amount of research happening in our field?
It's obviously been tough for pretty much everybody in different ways. You know, I think there are relatively few people for whom this has been a good thing, I would say. It's certainly slowed down research. I mean, many research institutions were partially or completely shut down for a while, including ours. So it certainly slowed things down. But I think the biggest cost in science has been the human interaction. You know, the lack of the ability to get together, to exchange ideas, to go to conferences. And I think we always knew that that was important, but I have a much heightened appreciation for that now, having been through this period of what I'll call isolation and having just started to go back to conferences again. I mean, having just been in Vancouver for the SNMMI annual meeting, it was just fantastic to see people again. And so many side conversations that just don't happen in a virtual conference that really, you know, led to new collaborations, new ideas, and this is what it's all about. And so I think we've all suffered through that lack of interaction. And even, you know, locally within our own lab, the inability for the grad students and the postdocs and the residents and the physicians to be getting together every week and chatting and having journal club and lab meetings. You know, just doing it virtually is not a replacement. So it's certainly been a struggle, but now that we're sort of beginning to emerge from it, I think everybody has a much greater appreciation for what we had before. And so maybe that's a good thing that we will cherish that that even more. And then I think we also have to address the whole work-life balance, working from home, working from the office, working in the lab, how that's going to look in the future. I think we've all seen that we can be effective in different ways. And for different people, it looks how that looks will be different. You know, it's one thing to work from home if you've got young kids at home versus if you're alone in your home. You know, you can be perhaps pretty effective if nobody else is around and it's nice and quiet. But for many people with families, this was an exceptionally hard time to try and balance the family responsibilities and the work responsibilities. So I think how we reimagine the workplace to make it the best it can be for everybody, to encourage the interactions, which is so important, as I just mentioned, but also give people the flexibility so that they can maximize their efficiency and productivity. I think that's another challenge that we're all thinking about.
Yeah, that brings up an interesting concept of the work-life balance and what do you compromise by giving more flexibility by working at home. And I know a couple of companies recently have put out a mandate that you have to spend all 40 hours in person. There are others, for example, my son's company has a very creative concept that you work from home on Mondays and Fridays, but you need to be at work Tuesdays through Thursdays so you can collaborate, come network, come up with the new ideas as a team. I suppose these are some of the concepts that will come through. For a radiologist to read the scans at home, it doesn't make much of a difference. But for a lab that's always thinking of innovative ideas, doing so at home can clearly compromise, as you stated very well. So you think that in the future, for labs, this will be potentially a balance where there will be some flexibility for working from home, but there will be some minimum required time for people to collaborate on site at work, right?
It's hard to think what the optimal solution is. And I think the problem is that it very much depends on the job responsibilities, as you just pointed out, and on the individual's circumstances. So I think that the challenge is, you know, if you want to be prescriptive and have a certain set of rules, you know, they're probably not going to work well for everybody. If you can be more flexible and trust that people will do the best they can, then you may get more out of people that way, and it may be more effective and efficient. So I'm trying within our environment to listen to what everybody's needs are and to think about how we achieve two things, which is one, foster community because it's so important, and at the same time, allow people some flexibility so that they can work in the manner which they think is most efficient. And perhaps in research, we're a little like, we've always had that flexibility to a certain extent. I mean, I've always had people in the lab that are late night people, for example. So they, you know, they won't show up particularly early in the morning, but, you know, they'll be there 10, 11, 12 o'clock at night. And then we have other people that are morning people. They love to get in early before it gets busy. And then they have access to everything in the lab before other people get there. And so we've always had that sort of flexibility. So why can't we extend that a bit more?
You are a role model to so many of us in our profession. Can you tell me a little bit about who influenced you along your way?
That's a difficult question because there's so many. I mean, I think one of the great things about the career I've had is all the wonderful people I've been able to interact with over the years. And essentially, you learn something from every interaction with somebody. So I could easily list hundreds of people that have influenced me. Of course, you go back to your key mentors, right? Your PhD mentors, who were Bob Ott and Maggie Flower, in my case, at the Royal Marsden Hospital in London. And then my postdoc advisor, Ed Hoffman, at UCLA, were very key figures because they spent a lot of time helping me and teaching me. So those were key figures. But there's many more besides that. You know, I've had the opportunity to interact with so many great people in our field over the years. And I've always been impressed by the generosity, the time that people take, almost without exception. We've had some wonderful people, leaders in our field over the years. You know, think of Henry Wagner, of course. You know, I enjoyed many conversations with him. And he always had time, even though he was an incredibly busy man. And so that's been one of the joys of working in our field, that I truly believe it's been very collaborative, very supportive. I've always felt supported by people in the field. And I've always learned, and I continue to learn. I still learn. It's not just the senior people. I learn a lot from my students, and I enjoy that very much. And so I think that's, again, coming back to what we were just talking about, these connections are so important. That's how you learn. That's how you progress. You bounce ideas off people. You hear people presenting their work, and that gives you ideas. This is so important. And I think the important thing I would want to say is that we're so much better as a field when we collaborate than when we compete. And so I think that's what I've always learned, that the more that we collaborate with people, the more we open up and work together, the more we can achieve. You know, and the Explorer project developing the total body scanner was a good example of that. We had to work with a lot of people to make that happen. And we had key contributions from so many people, both in academia and in industry, and of course, eventually from the funding agencies as well. So it takes a team to do these things, and collaboration is key.
Yeah, I fully agree with you. And you know, as you touch upon the collaboration, our earlier conversations about reaching out of our traditional domains and reaching out to infectious disease specialists, or going out to the immunologist to maximize our understanding of these complex systems is going to be the key to move our field forward in the future. And now you are getting involved more and more into multiple projects, and it must be keeping you so busy. So what do you do to get some kind of stress relief? What are some of your downtime activities? Not that you have so much downtime.
No, actually, I try really hard on the work-life balance because I think it's so important. And usually I can do my best work if I'm not stressed and if I have a good work-life balance. So that's always been important to me during my career. Of course, family is key. I have four kids. I adore them. And spending time with family is very important to me. I have other interests as well. So I'm a piano player, not a very good piano player, but I love to play. And being British, I love the garden as well. So we're just enjoying hundreds of peaches off our peach tree right now. And so those are some of the ways that I relax. And you know, I encourage all of our team members to make sure they take time away from work, because that change in environment and different stimulation, I think, is what allows ideas to come and the energy then to pursue those ideas. So I think, you know, it's very important that we find ways to balance the long hours and the stress of work that is almost inevitable in our profession with a healthy amount of downtime, other opportunities to pursue interests, vacations. I was lucky. My parents always insisted on a vacation every summer where the whole family would go. And that's a tradition I've tried to carry on in our family too. I think that's really key. So yes, absolutely. Work-life balance, really important.
Well said, Simon. And that importance is going to be even more critical in the future until we find more workforce pipeline solutions where individually we all will have to contribute more to continue to move the field forward. So the work-life balance is going to be more and more critical in the coming years.
And I think, you know, one of the things we have to focus on is not working more, but working more efficiently. I think we have to ask ourselves the question, things that we do during the day, how many of those are really important and really helping move things forwards? And some of the things we do are very important. Obviously, things around patient care, things around teaching and mentoring are really important. And then any of us that are in an academic institution with lots of committees knows there's a lot of other things that really are not great value for time. And so, you know, we should put our effort proportionately into the things that are most important. And that's one thing I always try to do rather than extend the working day to very long hours is just try to spend my time during the day on the important things and give much less time to things that, you know, are not that important.
And with that regard, I guess some of the repetitive tasks that we do, we can look forward to AI providing more solutions so that we can focus on more constructive activities.
Yeah, it's going to be fascinating to see where this takes us, right? I mean, there's so much excitement about AI right now, and rightly so, because the opportunities are incredible. But of course, we're sort of in the honeymoon phase, right, where people think AI is going to solve everything, and it won't, and it will not replace many of the things that we need to do, but it will assist. And I think that's exactly the point you were making, but it will assist us. It will take away some of the easy, redundant tasks that I think can be well tackled through AI approaches and allow us to focus on the things where we really need our expertise. And so that will hopefully improve the quality of our jobs. And that's a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. We all look forward to those solutions. So that's the wrap-up for today's podcast. I would like to thank again our special guest, Dr. Simon Cherry, for a truly engaging conversation. I can't wait to hear what's next. And thank you for turning into the SNMMI podcast series. I'm Munir Ghassani. Have a great day, everyone. Thank you.
SNMMI would like to thank today's podcast participants, SNMMI President Dr. Munir Ghassani and 2022 CASEN Award winner Dr. Simon Cherry. The Benedict CASEN Prize is awarded by the Education and Research Foundation for Nuclear Medicine and Molecular Imaging. It is in recognition of outstanding achievement and work leading to a major advance in nuclear medicine science. You can learn more about this award at MIERF.org.